Chapter 7. The Sword. Responsibility Enforced. Where there is a right, there must also be a duty to accord the right. In our society, we properly expect that duty to be fulfilled by our law through courts and other institutions of government. It implies the right, moreover, the obligation of enforcement against any who would repudiate or diminish another's right. We begin with civil procedure or police intervention, intensifying as required, ultimately until court order or arrest. We expect it. We are entitled to the protection of our rights as citizens. And we take it for granted, as surely as we take it for granted that it's good for our kids to be doctors and lawyers. Most of the time, as this culture of rights and responsibilities that I recommend unfolds, and as such law emerges, people will follow the law. But when they do not, when innocent lives or any other rights, including universal rights, are at stake, though the pen is mightier than the sword, it is mighty much more slowly, often catastrophically slowly. If one looked only at Rwanda, one would need look no further. Events frequently require justice to be realized more swiftly than the pen can bring off. In that moment, the sword spared is our duty failed. In recent history, that sword, the application of force to require responsibility, includes less overtly violent forces such as enacting economic sanctions, freezing assets, and denying travel or access to our banking systems. We are in varying degrees less reluctant to apply the sword in these its more genteel forms. It is at the point of application of violent force that we are reluctant, but very often our proper reluctance must be overridden by duty. Goodness cannot emerge if evil is not suppressed. Ibid. Justice merely demanded virtually always comes excessively late. In the critical moment, pacifism ought to be an ideal, but it must not be our prime motivation, or we will fail utterly and constantly in our responsibility to victims. It would be odd, at least, to depend upon only pacifism when the evil gun is at the head of the innocent child. We must not feel joy or righteousness in the power of our responsibility. It is no thing to celebrate. But sometimes, if people threaten and will not desist, they must be stopped by force or even killed. This is a horror. There is nothing happy in it. One might well cringe at the image of Christians laughing and cheering at the killing of Osama bin Laden. But even that does not diminish our responsibility. The responsibility that has befallen us as the beneficiaries of freedom and universal rights, whereby we are bound. If someone does not accept and respect the responsibilities of their freedom and everyone's universal rights, then we have a responsibility against them to that extent. That responsibility would instantly become meaningless without it being imposed, if necessary, by force. We certainly expect it within our country club. We demand that the sword be brandished at home where we regard it as law enforcement. At home, we are comfortable with force being swiftly and wisely applied to immediately end dangerous transgression. Indeed, our peace and security at home are the direct fruit of exactly such a systemic enforcement of rights. But across a national border, we think of it as another matter, something more sinister. We call it war. And most often, we object to international intervention for years, if not forever, no matter how gross the injustice perpetrated, how vast the number slaughtered, because we do not hold with the imposition of violent force, except to satisfy our feeling of entitlement to the protection of our own rights. But why is our responsibility to protect the rights of innocent people extinguished at a border, when circumstances cry out for their protection on the other side of the line? It seems to me such extinguishment cannot be taken for granted. If 400 of our adolescent girls were kidnapped from our neighborhood school and raped, protesters would not stand in the way of the police with signs demanding an end to imperialist aggression or chanting, "Give peace a chance." We require neither pacifism nor due process under multilateral treaties when it happens to us at home. On our side of the boundary, we might feel like accomplices if we do not intervene on behalf of the victim. But on the other side of the border, we are somehow comfortably complicit, thinking sovereignty protects us from responsibility. Do we think we are sparing the world interventions by force? Then why do we demand interventions by force at home? Having considered sovereignty, we see it as double-edged. While protecting our proper self-determination, all too often, it also protects despicable irresponsibility that we would recognize as our duty to suppress were it occurring within our country club. And so, if we seek reasons for not crossing the foreign border to enforce universal rights, sovereignty does not pass the test. We know that sovereignty must not be used to protect or mask abuse of universal rights. So, neither can it be used properly to excuse ourselves of the responsibility to protect the innocent anywhere. The shield of sovereignty does not withstand the sword of universal rights. Those who depend on sovereignty as their excuse for abusing universal rights must expect enforcement. Bandidos may expect Kemosabe to come plunging through the Rio Grande in Silver's galloping splash. Whether at home or away, justice is our duty and our highest responsibility. Our courts know very well how to consider such issues, and good law will emerge as quickly as we are bright enough for it to occur to us and make the case in court. When it occurs in a jurisdiction where the victims have no recourse to the courts, that is where our dire, unavoidable responsibility remains to be fulfilled. Let those who attempt justice to take up her sword be shown and shown well. She has been turned loose among us, but in only a limited way, and small minds have often turned her sword to their small ends. But justice is neither small, nor is she finished. If we hope to teach respect for rights and responsibilities, we must show respect. No abuse that calls upon itself the sword of justice must be excused, either at home or abroad. We are quite properly averse to a world that's based upon selfish interests, such as political or economic imperialism. When somebody else commits that error, though, we have little choice. Of course, we are quite rightly averse to war as well because it costs the lives of our soldiers. However, although our hearts are rent by injury or death of police officers, we are decidedly not averse to asking of them the ultimate sacrifice at home as a last resort. In our domestic policing situations, not only do we take it for granted, we demand it. Perhaps our aversion to war also comes partly from the implacable reality of collateral damage. The killing of innocents who happen to be in harm's way when the shit hits the fan. We tend not to dwell upon it precisely because it is as unjust as it is unavoidable, like tinnitus in rock musicians. Collateral damage is not much spoken about in public. Collateral damage occurs now primarily from bombing. It is that very nature of bombing that rightly makes it virtually unheard of as a tactic in domestic police enforcement. Bombing in war is precisely our attempt to use force against enemies by sacrificing innocent civilian lives rather than putting our own soldiers in harm's way. When those innocents are our fellow citizens, we will have no part of bombing. But when they are others the world over, it's bombs away. Not only are we failing in our duty to protect these innocents and their universal rights, we are writing them off to reduce our costs of living easy. Precision bombing is a fictitious construct like clean coal. It must be very difficult indeed for a person in the president's position to be at peace with this. They must prefer the deaths of innocent people by bombing to risking the lives of our own soldiers on the ground. But sovereignty is not alone as an unacceptable excuse against the sword of justice. There is also the abuse at home by those to whom we have entrusted the authority to enforce justice, by their failure to draw her sword upon themselves. The sword is not entrusted to those in authority to be used or not used to further their personal interests. Extraordinary influence may not be abused by its trustee to their personal advantage where any other person's freedom or universal rights are diminished as a consequence. If an abuser will not stop themselves, then they must be stopped by force. Dick Cheney and his fellow purveyors of torture enjoy a distinct advantage arising directly from this conundrum of morality seen in President Obama's drone bombs. If a president or vice president can be prosecuted for torture, then surely presidents can also be prosecuted for intentionally bombing innocent people. It is for these reasons exactly that Uncle Sam will not submit to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Torture and the bombing of civilians both are deployed for no better reason than to advance political objectives to avoid the appearance of failure, where fair play comes only at much higher political cost. As Duke Vincentio says in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, "He who the sword of heaven will bear should be as holy as severe. Shame to him whose cruel striking kills for faults of his own liking." So, if not upon faults of our own liking, in other words, arbitrarily, then upon what faults is it our duty to brandish the sword? I propose that the responsibilities of freedom and of universal rights be our guide. The sword of enforcement must be taken up across international boundaries and across domestic boundaries of power alike, if we are to live up to our duty. It so happens that Jesus of Nazareth considered this circumstance and shared his view quite clearly. According to the Gospel of Thomas, found in Egypt about the same time as the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in what is now the West Bank, Jesus said, "The kingdom of the Father is like a man who wanted to kill a powerful man. In his own house he drew his sword and stuck it into the wall in order to find out whether his hand could carry through. Then he slew the powerful man." Thomas, verse 98. It's little wonder this bit never made it into the Gospels sanctioned by Rome. Ironically, Rome's editing here was unquestionably adopted by born-again Christianity. It wouldn't help the power structures much, Jesus letting forth parables about slaying the powerful. Still, it seems that sometimes powerful men need to be brought to justice even by the sword. President Obama may well have gone to church very much at peace with his Lord, were it not for the collateral damage wrought by his drone bombs. Obama should have used the authority entrusted to him and turned the sword of justice upon the perpetrators of torture and of collateral damage. He should favor the indictment of George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld for sanctioning criminal torture. And having left office, he should personally surrender to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and petition that court to prosecute him for the war crime of knowingly and intentionally causing the deaths of innocent bystanders. He should admit his guilt and submit to the mercy of justice before the whole world. This would be his way to show respect, both for the law and for the authority entrusted to him. Then he would be regarded as more than a great president. In history, he would stand shoulder to shoulder with Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela, with Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King. Like Muhammad Ali, he would be the greatest, like Christ. This is how the trustee of the sword of justice earns the status and respect to stand up against abusers of freedom and universal rights everywhere.